We hope that you enjoy this teaching from Christ Church. This material is copyrighted and no unauthorized duplication, redistribution, or any other use of any part of it is permitted without prior consent from Christ Church. Please consider donating to this work in the San Francisco Bay Area online at ChristChurchEastBay.org.
Let me also say welcome to each of you. If you're new with us, we're glad you're here. We've been in a series this summer called What is Worship Anyway? And it's given us an opportunity to look kind of at the rhythm and practice or aspects and elements of Christian worship over the years. And we started a few weeks back talking about a call to worship. And we asked the question, what does it mean to be a community that's gathered together? And then we talked about a confession of faith. And we said, what does it mean to be a believing community? And we looked at confession of sin. We said, what does it mean to be a forgiven community? And then we looked at songs and hymns and spiritual songs. And we said, what does it mean to be a joyful community? And then last week, Jonathan looked at prayer. And we asked the question, what does it mean to be a dependent community? And tonight, we're going to look at the offering. What does it mean to be a generous or a grateful community? And I know when I say offering, already some of you are thinking, oh, money. Again, you know, I haven't been in church in a decade, and I left because they were talking about money. Here I am back tonight, 10 years later, we're talking about money. I could have stayed home, I could have watched TV preachers, all they ever talk about is money. What is going on here? Well, I think money affects us. It is impossible to be disaffected by money. We deal with it every single day. I think it is important, though we don't talk about it a lot as a church, to address this very important topic, as it does affect us emotionally, spiritually, relationally, every single day. A couple days ago, I took my family to Noah's Bagels, and that's become quite a rhythm and tradition in the Garrett house, particularly when Katie has other plans. I take the kids over there for breakfast, so much so that our middle of three daughters, Claire, who's now six, when she was three and she was learning stories about the Bible, she couldn't get it straight and she kept calling it Moses Bagels. Moses Bagels. Are we going to Moses Bagels? Moses is really into bagels, Dad. I said, no, it's Noah's. It's Noah's. And I take them there because I love the deal you get at Noah's Bagels. If you haven't familiarized yourself with this, parents, take your kids tomorrow. For $13, you get a baker's dozen worth of bagels and two schmears, and it's really fun to say schmears when you order them. So Friday we go, we order these bagels, and like we do every single time, each of us gets our own bagel, so all four of us had four bagels there, and then we take the other 13 minus 4, 9 bagels home with us, right? And we eat them the next day and the next day. So I get home and I'm unpacking the bagels, and I discover there are not 9 bagels, there are 8 bagels. And I put them out on the counter, and I, you know, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, I'm counting them over and over. I have the kids like, did one of you eat another bagel? Like, what is going on here? And I am incensed. I'm thinking, $13 for 12 bagels and two schmears. I paid $13 for 13 bagels and two schmears. And I'm feeling myself get agitated because I wanted the value. I wanted it because I paid for it. And all of us, to some degree or another, feel that way about money. Dan Allender, a Christian psychologist, said that we often attach more guilt and more shame than we do to money and wealth than we do to our sexuality. So I want you to hear me as a pastor who cares for you as we talk this evening about money. I've seen it dissolve marriages. I've seen it divide families. I've seen it deconstruct people's character. You know, if I were asked to address a recovery group on a retreat and I didn't talk about addictive substances, I would be unloving. Or if I address a group of recovering cancer patients and I didn't say something about carcinogens and what could happen and how they could wreak havoc on your body, you know, I may be unkind. And money can be an addictive substance. It can be a carcinogen in our life. And so to ease into that, I want to just invite you into two thought experiments, two questions. We're going to have two questions to address through Psalm 96. What is an offering and who is the rich? What is an offering and who is the rich? So here's a thought experiment for you. when we pass the plates or the baskets or whatever we have in just a few minutes later in our service, what do you immediately feel? What do you feel when that plate gets passed? And then here's a second opportunity for a thought experiment. You've been invited to address a large crowd of rich people. And after the dinner's done and they're clearing away the china and the plates and the silverware and such, you've got an opportunity to say one thing to this crowd of rich people. What do you say? So just hold those in your head for a moment, but I'll go back to the first one. What do you feel when the offering plate is passed? Nervous, anxious, guilty, ashamed? Is anyone looking at me? I feel uncomfortable. Should I be giving? Agitated or angry? Like the church is always reaching into my pockets. Like, what is going on in your soul, in your heart, when the offering plate is passed? And I would venture to say that if we approach the offering the wrong way, we may feel many of those things that I just described. Because some of us think of the offering as a bribe, right? God, if I give this to you, will you then do this for me, right? Or others of us, we might look at it as paying off a debt. Like, God, you've done so much for me. I've just got to give and got to give, and I've got to pay a little bit each month, and I've got to pay this thing off. Others of us might look at it as a tax or a fee for services rendered. Like, Christ Church takes care of my kids every week. I'm going to put a few bucks in the plate. You know, I had some pastoral counseling last month. It wasn't worth a whole lot, but here's $5, you know. Or lastly, you know, some of us see it as a tip. Like, this guy talks good or well. Or the music is really good. I love that song. So here's $20. But what is the offering? If it's not a bribe, if it's not a tip, if it's not a fee, what is it? And I think we best see it through an exposition of Psalm 96. This was called by many, by one commentator, the crown jewel of the Psalter. And I think one thing that the commentator was getting at was there are two movements in this psalm that I think are prescriptive and descriptive of a Christian community and a Christian life. And I want you to listen for those two movements as we sort of push towards a definition of offering. So as you're able, I invite you to stand as Psalm 96 is read to us.
A reading from Psalm 96. Sing to the Lord a new song. Sing to the Lord, all the earth. Sing to the Lord, praise his name. Declare his glory among the nations, his marvelous deeds among all peoples. For great is the Lord and most worthy of praise. He is to be feared above all gods. For all the gods of the nations are idols, but the Lord made the heavens. Splendor and majesty are before him. Strength and glory are in his sanctuary. Ascribe to the Lord, all you families of nations. Ascribe to the Lord glory and strength. Ascribe to the Lord the glory due his name. Bring an offering and come into his courts. Worship the Lord in the splendor of his holiness. Tremble before him, all the earth. Say among the nations, the Lord reigns. The world is firmly established. It cannot be moved. He will judge the peoples with equity. Let the heavens rejoice. Let the earth be glad. Let the sea resound and all that is in it. Let the fields be jubilant and everything in them. Let all the trees of the forest sing for joy. Let all creations rejoice before the Lord. For he comes. He comes to judge the earth. He will judge the world in righteousness and the peoples in his faithfulness. The grass withers and the flowers fall, but the word of the God stands forever.
Just one quick disclaimer. Each week we really believe here that the gospel is for people who are Christian and people who are not Christian. And we work really hard to talk to all sorts of people. And I would say this message may lean a little bit more towards Christians. And that's okay if you're not Christian. I'd invite you to overhear the conversation, to listen in. Some of you Christians that maybe brought a friend who's not Christian, give them a rain check. Like, I promise you, I don't always talk about money. Bring them back next week or whatever. We're glad you're here. But I want to just look at these two questions. What is an offering and who are the rich? What is an offering? First, as I mentioned, you see in Psalm 96 two movements, I think, that really mark the Christian church and the Christian life. The first stanza is all about worship. Sing, 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 sing to the Lord. Declare his praise. This is a coronation. The king has come, the coronation of the king, a new song is commissioned, and the people are worshiping. And Christians would believe that if you looked up the word human being, to find a definition in a dictionary at the heart of the heart of the heart of what a human being is. He or she is a worshiper. Ralph Waldo Emerson, in an essay entitled Self-Reliance, said, "We will worship something. Make no mistake about that. A relationship, a person, a degree, a new bike, a new car, the scratch we got on our new bike or our new car. Like, there is something in our life that we will give our life to." And Christians believe that we are most human, we are most ourselves when we are worshiping God as our high King of heaven. So in Psalm 96, in this first stanza, why are we worshiping this God? Well, we learn a couple things. First, we're worshiping him because God is not like the deaf and dumb idols. God is the one who made the heavens and the earth. We first say as Christians, when we worship, that God is creator. And in effect, we're saying there wasn't some sort of cosmic accident or plasmic burp, you know, or an electron that just had an indigestion problem. But as the story unfolds in Genesis 1 and 2, that no, God made, God created, it says, the heavens and the earth with you in mind. The quintessential high place of his creation, you. And he called it good and he called it pleasing. We also see in this text that we don't just worship God as creator, but we worship the God who brings our salvation. This is an assault to humanism. It's an affront to self-esteem and the self-help movement, because what it is in effect saying is that if God has created us to enjoy him in a good and beautiful and true relationship, but we had opportunity to do okay by ourselves, or worship creation, or worship ourselves, or our marriage, or our family, or our job, or whatever, then all begins to unravel. We need salvation. We need to be rescued. We need to be healed. We need to be saved. And this psalmist is singing this song of worship, thinking that Jesus, the Messiah that he may not even yet know, will come and sing this song and be the culmination and the climax of salvation. And Christians put it at the very centerpiece of their theology, a creator taking on the form of the created. A God who made everything, becoming unmade, unraveled, disassociated at the cross, that we might be remade, that we might be saved, that we might be recreated. So we worship. That's our first movement. We worship the God of creation. We worship the God of recreation. And then we work. We are in mission. Notice what the last stanza says. Let the heavens rejoice, let the earth be glad, let the sea resound. Say to the nations, que sera, sera. What will be. Say to the nations, you know, your origin, where you came from, doesn't really mean anything, and your destiny, where you're going, doesn't really mean anything, so your life doesn't really mean anything. No, say to the nations, the Lord reigns. And I know when you hear that, you think, well, is this God on the throne? I mean, I say that to my neighbor, I say that to myself, and their life is unraveling. Life is not safe. It's not good. It's not predictable. I've been scarred by injustice. The way I approach life is skewed by my lack of equity or my sense of fairness. Like, what is going on here? And we see this as a future hope and a future promise. Let us say, let the earth, let the trees, let the sea, let the fields, it says, the things that we ourselves exploit and unravel, let them one day say through our work and our mission, oh, God is coming and God is reweaving us together in equity, fulfillment, and delight. These two movements, worship and work, worship and mission, those are the rhythm and practice of the Christian church and what it means to be Christian and what it means to live Christianly. Now, what connects those two things together? There's a hinge or a fulcrum in this passage, and it's verses 7 through 8. It sets itself apart, really, in the Hebrew. It says, ascribe to the Lord, all you families of nations. Ascribe to the Lord glory and strength. Ascribe to the Lord the glory due his name. Bring an offering and come into his courts. Another word for ascribe is give, give, give. In other words, when you see this stanza, you see homage to a king. Walter Brueggemann, an Old Testament scholar, said, no one would ever come into the courts of a king empty-handed. You don't bring a bribe, you don't bring a fee, you don't bring a tip, but you pay tribute. And you pay tribute always with your first fruits. Because the king would then bless those first fruits, your time, your talent, your treasure, and then multiply them. Bless the work of your hands. So whether it's horseshoes or horseradish in those days, or togas and tomatoes, like whatever it is, you're bringing these first fruits into the presence of the Lord, of the king, and the king blesses them. Now, historically, the ancient church, the rhythm and practice in most every liturgy in those days had this verse, verse 8, as the summons to give an offering. Come into the courts and present an offering to the king. It's funny, my generation, and particularly my generation in this area, we think of the ancient church and getting back to the early church as kind of this sexy thing. Like, let's go and be like the church and just cut through tradition and cut through rules and regulations and let's just do it like they did it. But we so often fail to see how divested these people were of their resources, their time and their talent and their treasure. John Cassian, one of the early church fathers in 384, wrote this, if those faithfully offering the tithe of their first fruits were more obedient to the more ancient precepts, then they would more effectively scale the heights of the gospel and would not fall so short in their giving. And today those words are echoed. A mentor, Tim Keller, planted Redeemer Manhattan and helped start Christ Church. He talks about the tithe as kind of the bottom baseline or barometer to being Christian. And another theologian, Randy Alcorn, talks about the tithe or the offering as the training wheels of a generous life. The beginning, not the end. That's tough. So I tried to take this text and my own experience and these theologians in history and write out a definition for the offering. And this is the best I can do. Here is a definition of the offering. It's the giving of the first fruits of our time, talent, and treasure as tribute to the king, furthering his worship and his work. The offering is the giving of the first fruits of our time, our talent, and our treasure as a tribute to the king, furthering his worship and his work. So I've been doing this for 10 years now. Woohoo! Wow. I need another career. And I've learned in those 10 years that a lot of people ask questions about money and about offering in the context of church. And I get a lot of them, but the three I probably most get, one person would ask the question, well, how can I trust the church with my money? I feel like they always have their hands in my pockets. And I will say the church over the centuries has a lot to apologize for. One thing I love about Christ Church, one thing I love about Presbyterianism, and there are a lot of things I don't like about Presbyterianism, and presbyters, if you're here, I'm sorry for saying that, but Presbyterianism has this connectional relationship of accountability and authority, which is a very fancy way of saying we have kind of this federal, state, and local government. So when we start a church like Christ Church, the salaries, the operating budget, all of these things are approved state level by the presbytery, and then approved local level by City Church, the church that planted us, our home church. Another question that I get a lot as a pastor with respect to money and offering is, well, shouldn't I just give my money to a direct service provider? I mean, clean drinking water, education, sanitation, human trafficking. I mean, there's so many other things. I get more bang for the buck if I could just give straight to a direct service provider. And the first thing I would say is I empathize with those sensibilities. And Katie and I support a handful of direct service providers, and they are very, very important. But Christian, bear in mind that the church is an organism. I think of the church much like I think about a human being. And a human being needs input and output. Nurture, nourishment, exercise, activity. We put things into our systems and then we use our systems to invest, to open-handedly serve, love. So what a Christian is saying when they bring an offering to the church is that there is something about this table and the preached word and Christian therapy and pastoral counseling and children's ministry. There is something about those things that is just as essential and necessary for the growth of a human being and for our church as is living out lives that are mercy, justice, and peace oriented. Both are important. Both are essential to being Christian. Now, the third question I would get often, and it kind of turns us to the final of two questions we'll deal with this evening. So we're going to talk about what is the offering and who are the rich. The third question goes something like this. I thought the offering was for people with money. Like, I know other people are gifted that way. I'm not. So why should I give? Who are the rich? And it brings us back to our thought experiment. Because as you said, you know, I gave you opportunity. You get to address a crowd of rich people. The first question to ask there is, who gets a ticket into that room? I mean, what does it actually mean to be rich? And I know for a lot of us, we're thinking things like, well, it means they have more resources than I have, more money than I have, a little more or a lot more. The line is out there. I know I wouldn't get a ticket, so I know the rich is obviously other people. And I started thinking about that. Are we right to think that way? So I started kind of scribbling notes on, who do I think rich people are? And I think it's fair to say, rich people, for one, they may trade in their stuff sometimes. Like they may donate a sofa so they can get a new one or donate a television so they can get a new one. That would be a rich person. Rich people, after they graduate from high school, they may go on to college. And they might go to a school that has this catalog full of hundreds of opportunities, majors and activities and internships. And rich people, from time to time, they'll vacate their life. They'll spend time thinking like, oh, I want to have a great weekend somewhere. Let's get away, and I know I have a bed at my apartment or my house, but I want to go sleep in another bed. Or maybe I'll go travel for 2 or 3 weeks, and I'll go overseas. You know, so rich people will actually vacate their life and live another life for a few weeks. And what's more, rich people often have employers, bosses, that will say, hey, we're going to let you do that, and we're going to pay you to do that. So just take 10 days, 15 days, 20 days, just go out and do something great, and we'll pay you. Or if you have a baby or your spouse has a baby, you know what? You need some family time. So just go away for 6 weeks or 10 weeks or 12 weeks, and we'll pay for you while you're gone, and then you can come back. And rich people, they sometimes, like, they're tired of preparing food at their house, so they say, let's go out to this place, and we'll go and we'll sit down, and we'll look at this menu, and we'll order these things, and then these people will bring stuff to us, and we'll eat the food there, and then we'll pay them, and then we'll go home. Or if you're rich, you may eat at home occasionally, and you don't want to just drink water, even if it's clean. You want other things, so maybe it's soda, maybe it's beer, maybe it's wine. If you're rich, sometimes, or oftentimes, you'll pay premium dollars to ensure that the food you eat is sustainable, organic, local, ethical, fair trade, free range, single origin derived. You know, if you're rich, you may say something like I said last week, gosh, I'm having so much trouble getting my files from my laptop to my desktop. You see what I'm saying? In a recession, it's fair to say that maybe 5% of us are not rich. But 95% of the people in this room are rich. We are the top 4 or 5% of wage earners in the world, and some of us are the top 4 or 5% of wage earners in our country. You know, we have the top 1 or 2% education level in our world. And even if you went to Stanford, you're in the top 5 or 6%. We are, and if you went to Stanford, you'll get that tomorrow, you know. Or, you know, we are rich. We are rich. So if you're addressing a crowd of rich people, addressing a crowd of you, what would you say to a room full of yous? Well, we have this beautiful picture of what is said to rich people if you turn the page in this New Testament lesson, and I'll spend a handful of minutes in conclusion on this lesson. Paul wrote this book to his protege, to his mentoree, Timothy. And Paul had been at Ephesus, an affluent church in an affluent city, and he was leaving Ephesus, and he said, "No, Timothy, I want you to stay on at Ephesus. There are a lot of things I want you to remember." And the very last words that Paul wrote to Timothy before he left Ephesus were these words: "Command those who are rich in the present world not to be arrogant, nor to put their hope in wealth, which is so uncertain, but to put their hope in God, who richly provides us with everything for our enjoyment. Command them to do good, to be rich in good deeds, to be generous and willing to share. In this way, they will lay up treasure for themselves as a firm foundation for the coming age, so they may take hold of the life that is truly life." I'd like to conclude simply with the four application points that Paul commended to Timothy to commend to rich people. And I'll remind you again of this definition of giving an offering. An offering is the giving of the first fruits of our time, our talent, and treasure as a tribute to the King, thereby furthering His worship and His work. And I think the offering, the giving of the first fruits, is a great way to deal with our wealth. Remember the first thing Paul said: don't be arrogant, rich people. In other words, don't be high-minded. Don't think so much of yourself and just assume, you know, it's my ingenuity, it's my intellect, it's my imagination, it's my innovative ways, it's this particular degree, it's all of these things that I've put in order, these relationships at the right time. I deserve this stuff. And we become so full of ourselves that we fail to acknowledge other people, God Himself, that has put us in this position. So when you're giving a first fruit, in effect, you're reminding yourself, this is a gift. You know, people with wealth are, as I said, guilty people. We think we have too much, so we feel guilty. We think we don't have enough, so we feel guilty or embittered. And guilt sends us in a death spiral. And if wealth is a gift, then you wouldn't feel guilty. You'd feel grateful. Paul not only says, don't be arrogant. He says, don't put your hope, don't put your trust, don't lean into your wealth. And I watch people all the time and do marriage counseling, and you married people will probably hit your spouse here, but there's usually a couple ways that people deal with money. They usually either spend it or save it. And sometimes one spouse spends and the other spouse saves. And if you get underneath that, I think what you see is that a lot of people gravitate towards status. If I buy this or wear that or do this a certain way, then all of a sudden, I will have arrived. And other people live and lean towards security. If I store this up, if I get this nest egg, if I get my retirement in order, then I'll be okay. The first fruits, in effect, are paying down, paying against our penchant towards status, our penchant towards security. You know, if you got underneath spending and saving, status and security, you probably get to this thing called greed. We just hoard all of this stuff around us. But if you got underneath greed, you probably get to this thing called distrust. And you'd in effect be saying in your spending or in your saving, I trust these things and what they can give to me more than I trust my God. Don't be arrogant. Don't put your trust in your wealth. Put your trust in God, thirdly. Now, these two are inseparable. I tried to think of an illustration to demonstrate that. It's if you've ever been around a body of water and you've got like two boxes or two pieces of wood or two things that float, you know, and you try to stand on both of them at one time, it never works. Invariably, you're going upside down in just a second. And what Paul is saying is, don't put your trust, don't lean in, don't have crutches with your stuff. Put your trust in God. Now, my three girls have three jars, each of them, and these three jars sit on the same chest of drawers, and the first jar says, give, and the second jar says, save, and the third jar says, spend. And my kids don't really know why they're in that order yet. We're still working on that, but it's more that they live discombobulated lives that are all over the place, and their room is always in disarray. But whenever I go in their room, those jars are so turned around. It's spend, it's save, it's give, it's save, it's spend, it's give, it's blah, blah, blah. And they don't know the difference. But wow, how quickly we move those jars around in our lives. And we put our trust in other things, and we don't put our trust in God. Finally, be generous. Don't be arrogant. Don't put your trust and your hope in your stuff, in your money. Put your hope and your trust in God and be generous. It says live a life that is rich in good deeds. I would offer a closing illustration here that will convey this better than I ever could. And I've stolen this illustration because I've seen ministers use it in sermons probably half a dozen times, which means I assume it's pretty good. But, you know, if you're having your boss or an important person over to your house for dinner, you will premeditatively plan the meal. You know, you'll go to get the right meat and the right vegetables and the right wine pairing. You'll get everything in order to make it a beautiful, good, satisfying, appropriate meal. You know, you'd never take your boss or this important person into your house and say, you know, I knew you were coming. I know we've got some leftovers in the fridge. Open the door, like, here's some green peas mashed up that my kids enjoyed a couple days ago. This chicken's 6 or 7 days old. I think it's got a good day. I think we got one more day. You know, you would never serve an important person leftovers. People who are rich, you and me, who are generous or have the capacity to be generous, should be premeditative with our time and our talent and our treasure. I love being here where so many of you are given to social action and you're doing all sorts of stuff to help all sorts of people. And in some respects, you are rich in good deeds. But I would want to say to you, don't just see a need off that bulletin board or sign up for this off that website, but sit down much like you would labor over your finances and say, how should we spend money for this? We really want this. Or how should I save money? Or where can we cut corners? As much time as you would spend doing that with your finances, pull out your time, your talent, and your treasure and decide ahead of time with your first fruits. I'm going to give this time. I'm going to give this talent. I'm going to give this treasure as a tribute to the King, furthering his worship and his work. As you're able, I'd invite you to prayer as we prepare for the offering. So let's pray. God, I pray that my words fall upon people not as a money-hungry minister's words, but as one who cares about devotion and dedication and faithfulness to you. God, our checkbooks are moral documents. They probably convey more about us than looking in a mirror would. And I pray for myself, for our pastoral staff, for our leadership, for those in our midst and our congregation worshiping this evening, that we would be rich in good deeds, that we would be generous, giving, graceful, gracious people. Jesus, you have given yourself, thereby commissioning us to give as your hands and your feet. Be honored by our gifts, we pray. In the name of the Father, Son, and Spirit, amen.